article that we are looking at on today's episode really challenges us to look critically at occupation, and specifically how occupation can be used as a tool for either justice or injustice. Many of us have just narrowed our view of occupation, and this view is based on the medicalized and individualized categories of ADLs. Yet research and our own lived experience has shown us that occupation is much more complex, interconnected, and powerful than what you probably learned in school. The authors of this article outline how occupation has always played a role in systemic racism in the United States. As OT practitioners, we hold a shared value of justice. Thus, we must understand and confront both our nation's history of inequities and the injustices that continue to this day. Only by doing this can we move forward toward a true anti-racist transformation. After I share a breakdown of this article, I ask the host of one of my favorite OT podcasts, the Dr. Thoughts podcast, to do a takeover of the discussion part of today's episode. The Dr. Thoughts hosts, Ryan LaValle and Kalia Johnson, also happen to be the co-authors of the paper that we are exploring today. And I am so honored and thankful that they were willing to join us. So let's dive in. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we review new and influential OT journal articles, then invite on expert guests to help us pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Lyon, OTRL. And before we dive into this big topic of racism and occupation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast may qualify as continuing education for you. Now, you are probably listening to this podcast on a free podcast platform, but to gain CEU credit, you will need to be a member of the OT Potential Club, our OT evidence-based practice platform. As of this recording, it is just $89 to join us in the club, which I highly encourage you to do so because that is the place where we discuss papers like the one we are reading today. But bearing in mind that this could count as a CEU course, I wanted to explicitly state our two learning objectives so you can be thinking about them throughout the podcast today. Our first learning objective is you will be able to recognize the historical and sociological relationship between occupation, everyday living, and the construction of racism in the United States of America. And our second learning objective is you will be able to identify actions you can take within your occupational therapy practice and community to work against racism. So let's begin by looking at our journal article, and then I will bring Ryan and Kalia onto this podcast. So the article that we are talking about today is called Occupation, Injustice, and Anti-Black Racism in the United States of America. It comes to us from the Journal of Occupational Science, and it was published in 2020. So the article begins with this big picture introduction to occupation and racism. The authors share that the benefits of occupation have been well explored over the years. As occupational therapy practitioners, we are accustomed to linking occupation to health, well-being, and justice. However, very little research has been done to explore the role of occupation in the formation and the perpetuation of injustices. The United States has a long and atrocious history of racism. And in this paper, the authors argue that everyday occupation is situated in and inseparable from this racialized reality. Next, they head into this section on building on the politicization of occupation. They share in the past 10 years, there has been a movement within occupational science to understand occupation at a societal level. These include writings on occupational justice, the transactional perspective of occupation, the capabilities of approach, which we have also done a podcast on, and critical theory of occupational science. I'll link to all these readings in the club for you. But these theoretical perspectives have informed the author's investigation of race and occupation. And such views have fueled their belief that occupation is inherently political, which sets the stage for this paper. So, what was the intent of this paper? The purpose of this paper was to unearth the social formation of anti-Black racism in the United States. By doing so, the authors wished to examine the role occupation played in the creation of such fundamentally racist structures. The authors present a sobering picture of instances when occupation was the very vehicle through which racism was constructed. The authors also underscore the real and often unacknowledged history of racism in the U.S. Such racism must be recognized and confronted, especially by white Americans, in order to move towards reconciliation, healing, and social transformation. So after sharing their purpose, they head into the largest section, which is the occupational perspective of the history of racism. In this section, the authors share how race was constructed to create a false power hierarchy between those who were quote-unquote superior and quote-unquote inferior, which is horrific to even say out loud. But the institution of slavery was built to support this hierarchy, despite having absolutely no biological basis. In this paper, racism is defined as, quote, the deployment, intentionally or unintentionally, individually or structurally, of a categorization based on skin tone to place humans in this false hierarchy, end quote. Racist ideas and policies are those that support this false hierarchy. For their examination of this history of occupation and racism, the authors examined four main eras. First, associating dark skin with slavery and inferiority. Two, the development of occupational apartheid for Black Americans. Three, the continued occupational apartheid in the era of Jim Crow. And four, civil rights and reconstruction through everyday living. There is so much information shared about each era. I really encourage you to read the article in its entirety. But for the purposes of our podcast, I'm going to share two examples from this section that highlight the role of occupation. First, I'm going to share an example of occupation as a vehicle for racism. In this section on the development of occupational apartheid for Black Americans, the authors share that in the American colonies, those who were enslaved were designated as chattel property. This differed from most forms of slavery outside of the U.S., where those who were enslaved were considered freehold property. Now, this term freehold meant that the actual services and occupations provided by enslaved people were considered the property of the enslavers. But this designation of chattel meant that the enslaved people themselves were considered the personal property of the enslavers. Not only were their services under the control of the enslavers, but also their bodies and the bodies of their descendants. Slave codes and policies were created to ensure total control of the lives of those enslaved remained in the hands of the enslavers. These codes restricted Black people from the everyday occupations of things like gathering in public, reading or writing, traveling without permits, participating in any education, possessing loosely defined inflammatory literature, testifying against a white person, and many other activities. Codes of this nature continued long after the abolition of slavery, and they eventually evolved to become based on skin color rather than slave status. So the second example that I'm going to share from this section is an example of occupation as a vehicle for justice. During the time period of civil rights and Reconstruction, the authors highlight that many Black people were not allowed access to formal political power. Thus, the occupations of everyday life became tools to exert resilience and change. Participation in daily occupations became a way to resist segregation and racism. These daring actions included sitting on buses, waiting in train depots, sitting at lunch counters, hosting white visitors overnight, marrying interracially, wearing natural hair, creating music and art, dancing, having sex, and simply thriving. After the history through these four eras, the authors have a section on how the struggle for justice continues. They share that the civil rights movement was an incredible example of social change that leveraged everyday occupation. But the reality is that the U.S. is still not free from the remnants of slavery and racism. new policies and cultural norms continue to police, monitor, and control the lives of Black Americans. These include the war on drugs, the prison industrial complex, and voting restrictions. Dehumanization and violence against Black people continues to plague the U.S., as seen in the unjust deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Trayvon Martin, Monika Diamond, and countless others seen and unseen. And there are countless statistics about how attitudes and systems continue to unfairly impact Black Americans. Six examples of this: U.S. residents often assume higher crime rates are directly correlated with communities of color, even though there is no such correlation. Second, Black communities are regularly displaced for white real estate needs. Third, Black students are disproportionately disciplined compared to white peers who commit similar infractions. Fourth, Black Americans disproportionately receive inappropriate diagnosis and treatment of autism spectrum disorders. Fifth, Black Americans have a lower survival rate of breast cancer than their white peers. And sixth, a resurgence of white nationalist movements was seen following the 2016 presidential election. Racism is still alive in the United States, and it continues to be a public health crisis. In this section, they also share some statistics specific to occupational therapy. When last surveyed in 2014, only 4% of occupational therapists were Black. This is especially concerning when you consider that Black Americans compose around 13% of the population. Within the field of occupational science, the authors are only aware of two Black graduates who have earned their PhDs in the United States. So given all this information, what is the implication for occupation? This paper clearly challenges the long-standing assumption within the OT community that occupation is always beneficial. In reality, occupation can be infused with racist ideals and used to actively reinforce structural racism. This critical examination of occupation aligns with other recent writings that have called into question long-held assumptions about occupation. Such assumptions were born out of a North American/European perspective, which include an emphasis on individualism and choice, agency, and meaning. In their conclusion, the authors share that the potential for occupation to contribute to injustice calls for a more informed and conscious practice of occupational therapy. And while this paper has underscored how occupation can serve as a vehicle for injustice, it also showcased the opposite, the potential of occupation to liberate, empower, and promote health. There is so much to process and unpack from this article, and I, again, am just so grateful today to be joined by the authors. I'm going to read both of their bios, and then I will patch them on to this podcast. Dr. Ryan LaValle, PhD, MOT, OTRL, is an assistant professor of occupational science in the Department of Health Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Dr. LaValle has nearly 10 years of experience in community practice of occupational therapy. Broadly, his practice and research sits at the intersections of aging, housing, and anti-oppression. In 2021, as a postdoctoral fellow, Dr. LaValle was honored with the Office of the Provost Engaged Scholarship Award for partnership from the Carolina Center for Public Service. He is a primary lead for the department's community practice lab and has experience conducting community program development and evaluation in partnership with multiple partners, including nonprofits, local governments, and community institutions. His research has explored collective processes of everyday life and the sociological implications of doing together in community, including both positive outcomes such as language inclusion and negative outcomes such as racism. Dr. Kalia R. Johnson, PhD, MS, OTRL, is an assistant professor of occupational science in the Department of Health Sciences at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. She also serves as an affiliate research faculty member in the Center for Cultural Experiences in Prevention at Virginia Commonwealth University. Broadly, Dr. Johnson's research sits at the intersections of critical qualitative methodologies, intellectual and developmental disabilities, health equity, disability, and social justice. Additionally, she is involved in research aimed to address pathways to occupational therapy education for Black students and racial equity in occupational science and occupational therapy curricula. Her research interests are informed by 16 years of clinical experience spanning Georgia, North Carolina, and Virginia. And as I mentioned before, they are both the co-hosts of the Dr. Thoughts podcast, and they are actually going to be joining us for this episode and a following one. And on today's episode, loosely, Kalia will be interviewing Ryan, and then on the next episode, it will be flipped the other way around. So without further ado, I am just going to turn this podcast and conversation over to them.
Well, hello, everybody. It is a Dr. Thoughts takeover of OT Potential.
Hey, girl, hey.
So it is Dr. Kalia Johnson and Dr. Ryan LaValle here to chat about two of our papers. So this is a two for one, maybe?
I don't know if it's two for one, but it's definitely two.
Yeah. So, you know, we're going to dive a little bit deep about occupation and justice and anti-Black racism, but also take you through the commentary on racialized think pieces. Both papers appear in a Journal of Occupational Science. We'll talk a little bit about, you know, our own journeys in OT around practice and research, but also how the key points in our papers really link to practice and our own research and strategies for taking this up in various fields for listeners. So,
and we'll also give you a little bit of a taste of our own podcast, Dr. Thoughts, just, you know, because we love self-promotion.
Yeah. So if you are new to Dr. Thoughts, you're about to get some flavor right now.
Smart, right. Driven, fabulous. Here we go.
Yeah, here we go. So we're going to start this off with a question for you, Ryan. How did you first find OT?
Oh, I found OT because I loved biology and I loved psychology. And then I found my particular flavor of OT, which is community practice and sort of social OT in some ways, because I worked actually a lot with the homeless population in Cincinnati when I was doing my master's there and undergrad. And it sort of positioned my OT lens a little bit more towards social structures and social issues that people face, and how us sort of hanging out and doing things with the people who were living on the streets gave us a different relationship with them. And it sort of showed me the power of occupation in a social way. And so it threw me into this idea of like, well, how can we use the ways that we do things together in social situations to create really positive change? And that took me into community practice and took me to a PhD program where I had to figure out how to do the research on that type of practice. And that let me meet you. And, you know, for the listeners, Kalia is actually my big sister in our PhD program when I came in. So we've been working together for quite a long time, since about 2014, I think.
I know, long time.
So, wow. Yeah, I think that's sort of how I found OT. And then my flavor of OT in particular was just being thrust into community issues and really trying to see the vision for occupational therapy in those issues, not always through the health system, but in broader terms, using occupation for social change.
Okay. And you've already alluded to how your interest in those areas led you to pursue the PhD. But could you talk a little bit more about sort of your research interests specifically and how your clinical experiences have informed the research you're currently doing?
Yeah. So I definitely came out of my master's program wanting to work in community. I didn't feel called into a clinic or more of a clinical setting. I don't tend to call it a non-traditional setting because, as many people know, I think our traditional OT was out in community. So I might call it vintage OT that I was interested in doing, working with local governments, nonprofits, or sort of building community programs that might be a little bit more interested in preventative and primary care and health and other things that aren't necessarily that biomedical health, but just community well-being. And the responses I often got were, well, we don't have that. And I said, well, why don't we? And they said, well, we don't have a lot of evidence in the U.S. to support that type of involvement of OT in these sorts of community programmings. And so I said, well, how do we get that evidence? And they said, you have to do the research. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to do that research. And so I started looking at PhD programs, and, you know, when I applied to UNC, they understood my vision and were really interested in exploring that. And so they've helped me on a research trajectory of really understanding this phenomenon of occupation at a social level, studying how communities do things together for both good and bad, which we'll talk about today, but also not so focused on that individual experience of occupation, which is where my research has largely gone. And a bit more almost like a applied research is where I'm at right now, in the sense that I'm the primary lead of our community practice lab, and we partner with different organizations to help them develop community programming, whether it's related to aging or general community engagement or health promotion or those sorts of things. I work with various communities around our local university to essentially help them look through the process of building community programming using occupation as the tool and the means through which that social change can happen. And so I've partnered with Habitat for Humanity, the Marion Cheek Jackson Center, the Orange County local government on a variety of different projects, and largely have used the occupation-based perspective to inform all of that and the different skills that I bring as an OT as well, like activity analysis and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that is an incredible example of how to take, you know, practice experience together with sort of personal interests and use sort of the academic infrastructure and resources to really be able to do work that changes real lives and communities. I think often we get, you know, questions about whether or not OT really belongs in community or can do the sort of community level work that is often romanticized in text. It's like, no, this happens in real life. And so, in speaking again to that, you know, really deep understanding of social structures, you know, you led sort of our writing venture on occupation, injustice, and anti-Black racism in the United States paper. And so I want to shift our focus to talk about that a little bit. And yeah, if you could share with everyone why it was important for you to write this paper from a historical perspective. Like, some might call it rehashing. Like, why do we need to rehash history?
Yeah, I think so. This paper really emerged, I think, through conversations that we had a lot together, but also some teaching that we were doing together in our master's program around occupation and in the occupational science course, thinking about race and occupation and racism. And it really emerged in my dissertation, which focused on a senior center's occupation. And yes, I did say a senior center's occupation, you know, not just the individuals in that center, but sort of how the people in that center were doing things together, particularly related to an increasing amount of Spanish-speaking older adults in that senior center. And so as I did that research and in the conversations that we'd been having, it really became clear that the everyday living and doing of these different populations was sometimes helping to deconstruct racism and sometimes it wasn't. And, you know, as a white person, I was like, where did this racism come from in the first place? Like, what actually is the root cause of this? And because without knowing that, how can I really support a community in deconstructing it if I don't know how it was constructed in the first place? So it sort of sent me also via a couple different trainings and workshops that we have available in the local area, particularly by the Racial Equity Institute. You know, they provided a framework to look at that history. And as I dove in to really understand how these sort of racist ideas, structures, and systems were developed, I really saw occupation in a lot of ways. And through our conversations with students and saying, like, you know, you're working with students every day or with therapists and patients every day to think about how their everyday life is impacting them. And we see race and racism being deeply integrated into that. And so that historical picture really gave me the tools that I needed, particularly as a white person that, you know, this history has been largely hidden from in a lot of ways, the perspective that I needed to be able to approach the problem, I think, in a more appropriate way.
So, you know, that is, I think, well, personally, you know, I believe that this taking the historical perspective is a necessary step, right, for really understanding context fully or comprehensively. But people are still very uncomfortable about that. And so what are your thoughts on why people may think or feel uncomfortable about really digging deep into these historical perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, so as I said in the paper, one quote, I think it's actually maybe the first sentence of the paper, is the United States of America has a particularly extensive and atrocious history of racism. Everyday life, policies, spaces, economic systems, and social norms have been steeped in racism since the nation's conception, and I would actually argue before the nation's conception in its founding and in the ways that, you know, when it was quote-unquote discovered, you know, race and racism played a huge role in the genocide of indigenous people, as well as the continued enslavement of kidnapped Africans as the colonies were built, when it comes to the British and the ways that they actually did that work. So before our nation was even conceived, this was happening in part of the way that we built it. But that was, you know, we enslaved people on this land for over 400 years. And we have not enslaved people formally, I will say, for, you know, only about 157 years. And so we still haven't really even matched, nor even gotten halfway to the amount of time that we integrated this race and racism into our culture, into our society. And so I think that is why a lot of people are quite uncomfortable, because it's been so ingrained into our culture, into the ways that we do things, that it's picking really deep into scars that we have tried to believe are healed and tried to really forget that are there. But when we really look deeply at the violence and the horrificness of what was done to humans on this land for so many years, that makes particularly the white population uncomfortable, because, you know, it's been hidden from us, and purposefully so, whereas in many, you know, particularly in the Black community and in other communities of color, those stories have been told and they've been repeated and they've been used to warn and create fear, but also create protection among those communities. And the white population has chosen to ignore and hide that so that we don't take responsibility for the type of system that we originally built. So I think that's where we get that discomfort, is that it's like, once we can take responsibility for it and start to deconstruct it, that's when you can stop feeling uncomfortable with the reality of it. Well, you should feel uncomfortable always with the reality of what happened, but you don't have to feel as uncomfortable taking action in trying to deconstruct those historical sort of customs and culture that we have built for that many years, ultimately.
Yeah, because I think the misconception is, because people are so far removed or feel so far removed from the history, that they cannot perpetuate or sustain racist actions, even, you know, unconsciously, they don't come up. But the reality is, we've all been socialized a particular way, and those things can show up even in occupational therapy practice. Or the fact that the occupational therapy profession itself has also participated in sort of the exclusion of Black OTs and Black practices or Indigenous practices as part of what we understand or value to be occupation. And author, last name Black, talks about that extensively. And that is a resource that we can share with you all.
Yeah,
as
Black
well
2002 OTs Dance with Diversity. Yes. Absolutely an important article that probably, you know, could have spoken a little bit more directly to some of the issues that were faced, but was one of the first in our profession that really named the issue of exclusion and historicized the exclusion of people of color from the OT profession. And that wasn't until like the late 1900s that we really invited and welcomed people of color into our profession. And so, like, you know, some OTs alive today were there right. when that was still happening. And not to say, I mean, you know, I'm someone who asked you to take accountability. So I'm not saying it's not your fault, but you know, if you were there, you might have been participating in some of that exclusion, and we have to deconstruct that. So I don't know. I also just think that that's another powerful aspect of this being occupation focused, and we are occupational scientists, so we're not always thinking about the therapy side of things, but just that fact of that phenomenon of occupation. And we know the little things, you know, the little mundane things that make change in people's lives or build meaning or pleasure or whatever. And I think it's like we forget that this is in that level of our culture and society, even in the little routines and the little language that we use and in the way that we just live out our everyday occupation or everyday life. It's there, and we have to be extremely vigilant and looking and reflective about it so that we're not perpetuating it further. And I think that was also an impetus for this paper, was for occupational therapists to see that, you know, but also for people to just see that it's in the water we swim in, and that is occupation in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Now, I always love that phrase that is in the water we swim in. And I think that is one of the greatest sort of concrete implications for occupational therapy practitioners today, is that you can't be divorced from the history, right? That these roots, they run deep. And because they run deep, we have to acknowledge, we have to be critically reflective and all of the other, I don't even call them cursory, right? Necessary steps that you've already mentioned. But what are some other concrete things that occupational therapy practitioners should consider when it comes to the history of anti-Black racism and its connection with occupation and occupational therapy practice?
Yeah, I think, you know, being aware is one thing. And I really do think that that's the first step. But being aware allows for the second step, which is, I think, a lot more important in some ways, but, you know, a lot more effective in actually creating change, which is building relationships. And so if you're aware of this history, it's a lot easier to step into a conversation with your Black OT colleague and not step on something that is traumatic or problematic or say something that is sort of, you know, ignorant to a history that you just didn't know about. So knowing the history and knowing the language, or thinking about how we can build relationship as a knowing friend and ally in those conversations, I think is what this awareness of the history really allows you to do. And now I'm not saying like we should all go in and try and like be Black people or something like that. You know, like, oh, I can speak the language, or, you know, or something like that. But to be aware of why certain things are said, or why a particular comment in a staff meeting could be seen as really triggering or problematic, you know, that allows you to be a better ally. And also it allows you not to have to force that person to explain their experience of racism to you, because you understand the history, you understand its roots, and you're able to just empathize and go with them in that journey, and maybe even step up next to them as they defend themselves, or be there as a defense yourself. So I don't know. I think that history has really also put into, for me, like a real deep discomfort that just sits with you, that is needed to really make you question yourself. But for me as a white person, you know, in those conversations where I am not now, because I know this history, often like trying to lead the conversation in those spaces. There's just not really, given the history, given the reality of some of the trauma and violence. I mean, I think white people really don't know often the extent of the violence that was committed on this land and in this country, particularly to Indigenous and Black people. And so when you know that, it's a weight on me that reminds me to step back. and allow others to be in the space and lead in the space. So I think that's a real concrete thing that someone can do, at least as a white person. And that's, you know, the experience that I speak from most often, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
If y'all didn't know, I'm white.
Yeah. But you know, Ryan, a lot of what you are speaking to is about education, right? And we're talking about implications for practitioners, but there are real implications for occupational therapy educational programs. And so could you speak to that a little bit? Like, what are the considerations for what we teach, how we teach, maybe even who we teach?
Yeah. You know, I think that that's something that I've really learned by being alongside you in the classroom talking about this and seeing the different reactions to things that I say versus things that you say. And also hearing, you know, particularly students of color giving me feedback on things that they've really appreciated that a white person said in the room versus something that then they had to say, or calling out something that, because I know this history and because I've seen its progression, being able to really speak to or, you know, move that space in a different direction that they really appreciate. You know, and sometimes that means not prioritizing the experience and comfort of the white students in the room, but, you know, really prioritizing and making sure that that discomfort does sit in the room a little bit. So I think very practically, it teaches us as faculty members how to step into the space a little bit better. And again, bring in that knowledge as a tool that we can hold the space in a particular way. But I also think it recognizes again that we sometimes don't need to be leading the conversation, but leading the conversation, if you don't, like many faculties do, they don't have Black faculty, they don't have, which is an issue in and of itself. But, you know, if you don't have that resource to lead or that person, then you do need to be comfortable saying very direct and honest things. And the language that we use in this paper is particularly written very directly. And when we're talking about white supremacy, we talk about white supremacy. We don't use euphemisms. When we talk about enslavement, we talk about enslavement. It's not, you know, kidnapped workers or, you know, we enslaved people. And that's the language that we have to use. And so that, I think, is also a skill, particularly for white faculty who are uncomfortable talking about these topics, naming and framing them as what they are and being comfortable with that language. You have to practice, because we've been socialized not to use that language and not to talk about race because it's, you know, too political, or it's, you know, not really the issue, or those sorts of things. So I don't know. I think that's one thing that's really important for faculty members and our educational programs. The other thing is just that the content is there.
Right, right. You know? It's like faculty may not even teach to that particular content if, you know, our educational governing bodies, CCA code, NBCOT, yeah. If they are not requiring that educational programs even address it as part of a rudimentary part of our education for occupational therapy. So we hope that, you know, one of the other consequences of the education provided in this episode is that people get some real consideration about contacting ACOAT at NBCOT about the importance of this content to really having a more full and comprehensive understanding of occupation and how occupation is conceptualized, but also weaponized in the context of our country.
So, yeah. And I mean, honestly, as a profession, have to hold those policymakers, and I'm not talking about legislators, although we can talk about them on a different day. You know, I'm talking about the policymakers of our ACOAT standards and AOTA and our professional organizations. We have to hold them accountable as leaders and representatives of this profession. And yes, there's lots of, you know, broad dialogue and discussion and, you know, things going on in the media about critical race theory and how race shouldn't be talked about. Well, I think that it's a little bit naive, again, to think that for 400 years, this was the foundation of our culture and it's been dealt with. you know, and it's done and we've moved past it. Just like mathematically, that's just not correct.
The math not mapping.
The math is not mapping when it comes to this, you know? So I don't know. I just think that it's naive to think that. And yes, there's maybe people who are somewhat more inflammatory in the ways that they talk about these things, but at the same time, it's about digging in and being uncomfortable and saying that if you're practicing in healthcare in whatever profession, this is an issue and you need to be aware of how it emerges in your practice. You know, even if it is occupation, then we need to talk about it in occupation. But if it's in other ways, our OT practitioners need to be able to even speak to other healthcare professionals about this so that they can feel educated enough to call it out in those systems and in those hospitals and in those clinics. You know, so it's not just like, well, I only speak from occupation. No, you speak from an educated perspective on race and racism in this country. And that's what I think we should be providing in our programs to prepare students to really be anti-racist practitioners, you know, when they leave our programs.
All right. So how about the folks that are already in practice? So how can practitioners use this knowledge to inform their practice and justice work specifically?
You know, I think one of the things that history teaches us is how it's repeated. And, you know, you can see that with the different phases in this article that we really try and unpack and sort of show how, yes, race and racism was sort of expected and built on and used in the beginning. And then in Reconstruction, it was like a big challenge to that and a challenge to how it was constructed. And then Jim Crow came and essentially tried to repackage that same racism that was originally there in new ways and in policing and how our systems were built in education. And so I think that when you're out in practice and you're sitting in a hospital or in a skilled nursing facility or something, if you're aware of how this has been packaged in the past on multiple renditions and revisions and reprisals, then it's a lot easier to see the false wrapping paper in this new vision or new revision, new remix, if you will, of racism in the healthcare system. And so if you're not aware of that history, it just might look like a pretty package to you and it's all fixed and done. But when you know what can be beneath that pretty wrapping paper, because you know the history, then you're much more well prepared to call it out for what it is and unwrap it for what it is in front of your colleagues and not allow it to continue. So I think that's the biggest thing that I hoped for when we were writing this paper, is that people could take that education forward as a tool to analyze what's happening in front of them. But I also, again, think it, when you're talking to a patient who is not like you, who has a different skin tone than you, this history is there. And to walk into the room with it in your body, as much as it is probably a lot more in their body, changes the way that you interact with that person. So your therapeutic use of self will change, and the interventions that you choose will change, and the way that you listen might change. And so I think that it's very deep when you really understand the reflection that's necessary for this sort of knowledge to impact your practice. It's not just like, well, I know that we did this bad thing, so cool. It's really letting it sink in to the way your body moves and stands and even presents to a patient who is different from you.
Yeah. I'm sort of thinking about clinical reasoning and the way that we talk about it and even teach it, and you know, the depths through which people have to be critically reflective when it comes to understanding space and place and histories tied to that is quite beyond, I think, what we do in the classroom around clinical reasoning. So I think our students will often draw on that, right? Sort of, how have I been instructed to think through these things, including therapeutic use of self? But again, I think it goes back to our previous comment about sort of valuing these processes and content in occupational therapy and occupational science curricula, and saying to ACO and NBCOT, like, we are not completely ill preparing our students, right? But there is a real sort of missed opportunity here to really prepare students to enter into a more diverse and global society as practitioners.
Well, and I also think it's a skill. Like, I mean, this, it's like a transferable skill, if we want to use therapeutic terms, in that, like, and this is how I came to understanding race and racism. You know, as a queer person, I, through personal experience, learned how to see a society that was not built for me to thrive in some ways, you know. But I, as a white male presenting person, I definitely can also see how the society was built for me. And so having that skill of looking at society's relationship with the self in the everyday life of a person is a skill we want our students to have, and we want our practitioners to have across all of these systems, not just race, but race in this country is so deep and so intensely ingrained in our culture. If you can get to race, you often are pretty at least skilled then to be able to look at these other social situations and be able to critically analyze for power and oppression, you know, and that's a skill that we want our students and practitioners to have. And so it's not just that we want you to marinate in the atrocious history. It's that by doing so, you actually gain a skill to be a better practitioner in the long run. And I think that some people just don't realize that to be able to sit, especially if it's not a personal experience of you. We work a ton with people with disabilities, right? And if you can't critically look at systems and understand how the environment or systems are disabling people, much like race and racism do, then you're probably practicing with ableism in some ways. And so there's just this transferableness when it comes to critically analyzing these social situations that I think we often forget, and also allows us to be divided and say that, well, I'm talking about ableism, I'm not talking about racism. Well, they are different, but they also function very similarly.
Yeah. No, and sorry to listeners, I'm actually gesturing how they are how they are tied together. And that, I mean, we're not talking about that particular paper in this episode, but I write about that in a paper that was published in Inclusion on Proposition for Race-Based Research.
Ooh, give us a preview.
how racism and ableism are also inextricably tied. There isn't a whole history to disability and how a disability is conceptualized through a racialized lens as well. So sorry to tell y'all folks, you can't really get away from race. It is, or racism, I should say, right? We don't need to conflate the terms, but yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, maybe unpack that just we shouldn't conflate race and racism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, just understanding that, you know, race as a social construction speaks to skin tone, right? But when we're talking about racism, we are talking about a system of oppression that is based on one's skin tone. And so often when we read about race sometimes in the literature, we're talking about outcomes or these, you know, terrible things about groups of people that are somehow based on the color of their skin. But people, for let's take diabetes, for example, you know, and the disparate outcomes of diabetes and diabetes care and management that is often reported about Black people, like those outcomes aren't a product of being Black. It is a product of a system that oppresses Black people and being able to get quality care or the products that they need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so the way that it is often written about is like, well, if you're Black, this is what's going to happen, or that your risk is because you are Black. And that's not race, that's racism.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think that's it. So we're also speaking particularly from a US context where race is really based on skin tone. And there are other racisms and races that have been constructed in other societies based on religion, based on ethnicity, based on literally a line that somebody drew on a map. You know, and so race is this false hierarchy, as we say in this paper, that has been created. And so that's another skill, I think, that practitioners sometimes don't realize that it's really easy to listen for. If somebody says that something is because they are Black or because they are one race as opposed to another race, that's usually wrong. Like, pretty much that's been proven that that's wrong. There's no reason that, you know, because someone is Black, unless it's like you have more like melanin, you know, like that is biological. Yes, you have more melanin than other people. And so there's probably some science relationships there. But if you're talking about anything else really that creates a disparity or creates a difference in norms of bodies and that sort of thing, then usually that's racism that's creating that problem and a society that has created that disparity, not a biological effect. That's the great lie of race and racism, right? Is that this is rooted in the body. It's something that's biologically different, and therefore we can come to a conclusion that there are biologically different norms or standards or assessments. So if you ever see a standard norm that takes race into account, then that's racism, usually.
Right. And so, the unfortunate thing is it's still very, very prevalent in our healthcare system. And also something, cough, cough, we have to consider in the assessments that we use in occupational therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's hope, Ryan.
Yes.
Right? There is hope. Says, so what
says
hope
the,
do you
the
have?
The Black person to the white person. Really, Kalia? There is? Oh my gosh.
Keep hope alive.
I love it. Yes, I think there is hope. And I don't need to tell you that, but I think that there is hope, particularly. I mean, I have hope in our students. I see so many students who are coming up, both students of color and white students who are arriving with these questions, and we don't even have to bring them up. They want us to be talking about it. They want to be having these conversations, and they want to be practicing differently. And I think it's ready for like us to really think about a change in our profession. And so I think that's one thing that's really giving me hope, is this next generation of students who are lifting hard on this issue to get us as faculty to really react and think about how practice can be different. But I also, you know, I see practitioners out there who are doing this work, who are asking uncomfortable questions, who are leading. You know, we have wonderful leaders who, like Dr. Kalia Johnson, you know, and other wonderful practitioners who are not afraid to bring real talk to the front and say, this is the reality. This is what's going on in our profession. But we've also historically had those leaders who have either sometimes been silenced or excluded. And we have to recognize, again, that history and pull them forward and continue to honor what they contributed to our profession. And so they also sort of, from an ancestral perspective, give me, not my ancestors, but, you know, in certain ways, we don't want to talk about my ancestors, but, you know, the OT ancestors give us some hope, particularly those OTs of color who have really asked these questions in a hard way to really bring about more liberation and justice through our profession. What about you? What hope do you have for this issue, Kalia?
Oh, gosh. What hope do I have? I think primarily that there is going to be a real concerted effort from our national governing bodies to really pay attention to the ways that we integrate this history into how we teach our occupational therapy students, that we don't treat it as an elective, that we don't treat it as a DEI project, that we don't pass it off to faculty of color across other programs to figure out how to do, but that we decide as a profession that we're going to hold a mirror to ourselves, reckon with our participation in the system and say, this is how we're going to rebuild it and do better. Because if not, we'll be left behind in this particular way. as well. But like you, I have hope in students and practitioners that are doing this work that aren't afraid to take up the mantle and do the hard work that needs to be done. But too often we see that those are also students and practitioners of color.
Yeah.
And so for those people who call themselves allies, I hope you can take up the title accomplice, right? Being an ally is also easy work. but to step on the front lines with others in doing this education for self and for others, it's really what's going to be required to see the change that we talk about. And the other thing that I hope for is the day that I don't have to talk about this anymore.
Ooh, preach. Yes.
You know, because we've talked about this on Dr. Thoughts. Is y'all, I'm an intellectual developmental disabilities health services researcher. That's what I do.
But wait, you're black.
But yeah, you know, that automatically makes me a race scholar, apparently. But but while, you know, it is, I don't know if you call it a calling or not, but whatever it is, you know, I'm stepping into it graciously with Stiletto Heels, though.
Like, oh, yes,
I'm gonna stump on you about it. But it is not the only work that I do. And it's not even the primary work that I do. So that is my other hope. Yeah. Ask somebody else. I'm just kidding. Yeah. That Dr. Thoughts flavor, y'all. Dr. Thoughts flavor.
Yeah. No, I think that's important for people to hear, though. And I really appreciate you sharing that because, you know, we do rely so much on faculty and students of color to be the ones doing the energy and the work of this. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next episode. But I will also say that there's always work to be done, you know, and to be quite vulnerable in the sense that for our division, you know, we just recently had a crucial conversation about this and really opened up a space where we wanted to hear from students about how we were doing celebrating different racial and cultural diversity. And they told us that we needed to be doing more, you know, and that we talked and we do some things, but there's always more to be done. And we hear that and we listen and we want to move forward with real concrete actions. But, you know, I think that that's important also for listeners to hear is that, you know, we're two faculty members who literally are in offices right next to each other in the same division. Right. And our students are still telling us we need to do more, you know, and we are people that have thought and talked and worked on this issue quite a bit in OT. And so to have students say that to us means that we need to be listening even more across our profession. So that also gives me hope in that you know, we have students who are ready and willing to challenge people who are out here, like, trying to do the work and still saying you need to do more. And I really appreciate that from students and that movement forward in doing the work.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for those sweet words. So I think to wrap it up, we are going to do a little bit of rapid fire. So quick questions, Ryan. Finish this sentence for me. Occupational therapy is?
Complicated. No. I say that because this particular paper, I think I was really trying to complicate occupation. I was really trying to make it less of a one note. It's always good. It's always helpful. And really rip the curtain back and say, look, you know, occupation can be problematic. And we have to be aware of that and look at the history of it. So I would say occupational therapy is complicated because occupation is complicated. But the complicatedness is sort of a joyful place to be in as well, to be able to acknowledge and appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the one moment in therapy you will never forget?
Whew, I should have thought of this before. I will say this is not relevant to race and racism, but you'll get to just know me a little bit. I was working with a family in community. Both parents actually had dementia, and the caregiver had recently been released, but not fully released from prison to care for his two parents. And the moment that I will never forget is when I heard that he really wasn't able to care for them anymore. because he had the structure of sort of parole and house arrest for a long time because he was still incarcerated technically. But when he did finally formally get released, all that structure fell away and the system failed him in being able to take care of himself, to care for his older adult parents with dementia. And so it was just another realization that I can give all the assistive technology, I can give all of the therapeutic strategies and things, but if the system fails the people, then we have to change the system. And my one intervention isn't always going to be the solution. So that was a pretty big moment for me, I'd say.
Wow, that incredible, incredible moment. Feel kind of weird moving on, but...
sorry.
But you all sit with that. Like that is real. That is real. That's real. So how about any closing thoughts? Like, what do you think is the most important thing OT practitioners can take away from this conversation today?
Well, you know... again, I speak from a white experience. So for the white OTs out there and students and practitioners and faculty members, I think that the biggest thing you can take away is to question and to reflect and to pause before acting on any of this, because it takes deep reflection and pausing to really feel out where your place is in this work. You know, for the non-white OTs and practitioners, the one thing that you should take away is that you've got someone in this profession, I think in me, as well as obviously in Dr. Johnson, who are trying to push this conversation forward. And there are multiple of us out there, and that you can find us and build a network of support. So if you are feeling alone, and you probably know a lot of this history that's in the article already, but if you're looking for people who are interested in really building solidarity with across this profession, we're out here, and that you can come find us and knock on our door and we'll answer.
All right. Well, thank you for chatting with me, Ryan, about occupation and justice and anti-Black racism in the U.S.
And thank you for asking me lots of good questions. I get to turn the tables in the next episode.
All right. See y'all in part two.
Well, you all, I just again want to extend my heartfelt gratitude to Kalia and Ryan, both for just writing this paper and then for being here today to discuss it with us. We have talked over the past couple episodes of this podcast about how complex problems really take teams and teamworks to work towards solutions. And I love how their friendship and the trust in it is just an example of that kind of teamwork. You can hear more from them on the Dr. Thoughts podcast, and they will be joining us again on our next episode to discuss a follow-up paper to this article that really calls on the OT profession and occupational science to take an anti-racist stance and gives us some ideas of what that can look like. I also want to encourage members of the OT Potential Club to share your thoughts and your questions in our forums. The OT Potential Club is also where you will go to earn a certificate for your time today. All you have to do is take a 5-question test, and we will generate a certificate for you. In the club, in the upcoming weeks, we will also share our breakdown of this next paper on anti-racism, which Ryan and Kalia will be back on our podcast to talk about next time. And I just want to close by thanking you so much for joining us today. I hope this podcast helps you broaden your knowledge, tweak your practice, and stay evidence-based. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time.